This message comes from NPR sponsor, MassMutual. The Financial Educators Council says 39% of Americans don't have someone to go to for financial advice, but you can plan for the short and long term with someone backed by 170 years of financial expertise at MassMutual.com.
Support for NPR and the following message come from NYU Stern. Their executive MBA program provides the support you need to take that next great leap. Classes held one Friday, Saturday, Sunday a month in downtown D.C. Search NYU Stern EMBA in D.C.
Bullseye with Jesse Thorne is a production of MaximumFun.org and is distributed by NPR.
It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. Can you draw a through line in the work of Adam McKay? Are there common elements? He's had a pretty eclectic career. He started in sketch comedy, first as one of the founders of the Upright Citizens Brigade, then as a writer on Saturday Night Live. He worked on the show between 1995 and 2001. He studied at Second City, too, so throw that in. Then he started working in movies. He collaborated with Will Ferrell to do some stone-cold comedy classics, Anchorman, Step Brothers, Talladega Nights. Starting in the 2010s, though, his work got a little more serious, topical, political. A few years back, he wrote and directed The Big Short, which deconstructed and explained the 2008 financial crisis. I guess if there is a common thread in McKay's work, it is that he sells it. It's never boring, never forced. He'll take an extremely dumb joke, like, I don't know, stinky perfume that smells bad, and frame it in a way that's so clever and compelling, you lose it. Or he'll find a way to explain credit default swaps that's so funny, bizarre, and novel, you forget you're learning about credit default swaps. Recently, McKay has made his first foray into podcasting. Death at the Wing is a documentary series that takes us back to the 1980s, focusing on a spate of deaths involving young, promising NBA rookies and prospects. It looks not just at sports, but at the politics and socioeconomics of the time and how all of those things were deeply and tragically interconnected. When McKay and I talked in 2019, he'd just directed Vice. Vice is a biopic about Dick Cheney. It's probably fair to say that pretty much every American has an opinion of Dick Cheney, who's played by Christian Bale in the movie. Cheney is gruff, droll, kind of blunt, a little bookish. Vice tells us why, for better or worse, Dick Cheney is one of the most consequential people in recent history. And since it's an Adam McKay film, Vice finds the most compelling and fun way to show us that. Like in this scene, one of the pivotal ones in the movie, where George W. Bush, who's played by Sam Rockwell, asks Cheney to be his running mate.
The vice presidency is also defined by the president. If we were to come to a different understanding.
Go on. I'm listening.
I sense that you're a kinetic leader. You make decisions based on instinct.
I am. People always said that.
Yeah. Very different. Very different from your father in that regard. Now, maybe I can handle some of the more mundane jobs, overseeing bureaucracy, managing military, energy, foreign policy.
That sounds good.
Adam McKay, welcome to Bullseye. It's nice to have you on the show.
Thank you for having me.
You just spent years of your life making a movie about Dick Cheney. Are there things about Dick Cheney that you like and admire?
Yeah, part of the goal of the movie was to dive into the mystery of this guy. And, you know, who was this guy who very quietly took the wheel of our country, of our democracy for, depending on, you know, what you believe, 6 to 8 years and had this amazing influence. So, you know, a lot of people jokingly call him Darth Vader because he survived all these heart attacks. He has kind of a gruff, cold exterior. So there's no question we were looking for the human being behind it. And absolutely, I found some things, especially in his early life, pretty regular guy from Wyoming. Really what changed his life was he fell in love with Lynn Vincent, who became Lynn Cheney. Fell madly in love with her, and she had a lot of ambition. Very smart woman. But the big thing about Dick Cheney that you find yourself admiring is loves sincerely crazy about his family, crazy about his wife, crazy about his daughters, did all the shopping for the family and did all the cooking for the family. That really became the human backbone of the movie, was this devotion to his family. And you even see the fishing metaphor kind of runs through that when he tells his daughter, well, it's not a good trick or a bad trick, fishing, but if we catch a fish, our family gets to eat. And so that's kind of the base of the entire emotional arc of Cheney. And then obviously in the end, you see, I don't want to give it away, but some complications regarding that family.
How did you decide to make this movie and to a certain extent your previous movie in the form that you did, which is to say that they almost take – these are narrative fictional films about real life events, but they almost take the shape of like a, you know, an Errol Morris movie with less interviews directly facing the camera. Like they're almost documentary like in their structure.
You know, the big I love The Big Short was one of my favorite books I had read. And then a couple of years had gone by and I just was wondering why it hadn't been made. And a movie I had seen before that I really loved was 24-Hour Party People by Michael Winterbottom. It's a great little movie if anyone out there hasn't seen it. And also, I come from a background in Chicago of long-form improvisation, which is influenced by story theater. You know, Mike Nichols, Elaine May, a lot of those people came through it. Part of that is breaking the fourth wall, using monologues and then going into scenes. So that kind of coupled with my realization after seeing 24-Hour Party People, like, oh, you can do this. And it's actually pretty seamless and kind of fun. So I knew the only way to crack The Big Short was to play with form a little bit. It was very natural to that movie because the financial products were so esoteric and confusing and, of course, were designed to be that way. With Cheney, it was a different motivation. With Cheney, it was the fact that his power was so quiet. It was so bureaucratic. It was so built around papers and desks and hallways. And yet this power was changing the world. So I wanted to find a way to bridge kind of this office bureaucratic know-how and understanding of the government with actual human impact about what's going on with the world. And also at the same time, keep the audience off balance. My worst fear was that they would settle into kind of a traditional biopic. And I just didn't want that comfort to run through the movie.
Well, in some ways, what the movie is about is Dick Cheney creating comfort in America and even within the administration, like creating a sense that things are just kind of moving along while doing extraordinary things.
It was, we actually say it in the movie, it's one of his superpowers, and a lot of people around him confirm this, that he has the ability to say the craziest things and make them seem very professional. You even look at photographs of him during the Ford years, there's a lot of him like stretching over behind Ford, kind of as his right-hand man, talking into his ear, leaning on the desk towards Ford. We actually discovered, Christian Bale and I, at one point, that really one of his strengths is he's kind of the ultimate codependent to power. He really presents himself as someone who's going to make your power greater. And it's an unusual road, but that's a lot of where his power came from.
There's a gag in the movie where, as you present that idea, the idea that his superpower is basically to be so boring and so normal seeming that he can say the most extraordinary thing without notice and have it be agreed to. You go full on with a gag that could have been in Talladega Nights or something.
Without a doubt. Yeah. I mean, it's, we wanted to shock the audience, and it's very fun seeing the audience thinking they're in this dusty old biopic, and then suddenly that line is said by a character. Yeah.
I mean, I can't really repeat most of it on NPR, but it does end with, well, I do like a good puppet show.
That's Henry Kissinger saying that. Yeah. Yeah. That's the one thing you can say.
It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. My guest is director Adam McKay.
You were a founding member of the legendary sketch and improv group, the Upright Citizens Brigade, which you left after not that long. But you participated in a very famous UCB show that involved flyering the neighborhood.
The city.
The city.
Yeah.
Before the show. And like the UCB was always engaged in like trying to make improv shows almost into happenings, pulling people into the street, things like that.
Definitely, yeah.
This was probably its grandest manifestation though.
Yeah, we went out, papered the city, handed out flyers on subway cars, the L, basically advertising my own suicide. I'm assuming this is what you're thinking.
Yes.
And I had had a really terrible headshot done a couple of years before that was super cheeseball, where the photographer's like, smile bigger. And we used to always laugh at my terrible headshot. So that was the picture. And it just said, on such and such date, Adam McKay will kill himself. And then in big letters, no joke. And there were some people that were concerned. And then during the show, at one point, this is how long ago this was, we went to a local real estate guy and they had a building across from the theater that was like seven stories high. And I think it was the Flatiron building. And we said, can we get on your building and can I yell to a crowd that we're going to pull out of the theater? And once again, the mid-90s. And the guy's like, sure. I always support the arts. So we drag the audience out of the theater and I was up on top of this building yelling, is this what you want? Is this why you came here? And I could hear Del Close down there going, jump, jump. And then I backed up and we had a CPR dummy dressed as me. And it really did. I mean, from far away, it kind of looked like me. And we threw it off the building and I could hear the crowd gasp for like half a second. The body hit and I was dead. And then meanwhile, I ran as fast as I could downstairs. We took an elevator and then bolted out. And then a guy named Armando Diaz, who now runs a theater in New York City called the Magnet Improv Theater, he came out as the Grim Reaper to claim me. And the UCB bribed him to go away. And then I snuck into the group and popped back to life. And we all went into the theater with cheers. But that was a good time.
Why was it important to you to make a scheme as grand as that one? When you, to be fair, like, were probably earning $30 from that show.
I don't even think we made that. I think we made zero on that show. We would save the money to buy our props. So we weren't making anything. We were all teaching improv on the side. I think that's how we did it. You know, we were the whole fun of the initial Upright Citizens Brigade and obviously evolved into something different and wonderful. The beginning was, you're right, it was like happenings. It was pranks. We would just do things you weren't supposed to do. We took the whole audience back to my apartment once, and because it was our first floor apartment, and it played out a whole murder scene where Horatio Sanz busted in the room and killed a guy who was like an actor, and it looked like a real apartment. Part of the audience was like, what are they doing? We just did all kinds of things like that and took the audience into the street and improvised a scene over an intersection where it was like Thanksgiving dinner. And, you know, we were in our 20s and we were just – it was that last time you could kind of do stuff like that before people started really freaking out about insurance and little things like the law. And the whole spirit of the Upright Citizens Brigade was you really don't know what's going to happen at these shows. Remember another time we had a guy planted in the audience, a lot of great actors in Chicago too. This is a guy no one would have known, but he was a good actor. And in the middle of our show, he said, what are you doing, sir? Why are you writing notes? And he's like trying to blow us off. And then it turns out that he's Richard Christensen, the biggest critic in Chicago for, I think, the Tribune. And we all say, let us see those notes. And we start reading them and they're terrible. They're panning our show. And we grab him and we run him out of the theater and throw him on the street. The audience follows him and we tear up all his notes and we scream at him and say, don't ever come back. And for a week, it buzzed all around Chicago that we had thrown Richard Christensen out of our show and torn up his notes. And I believe the real Richard Christensen had to say, like, no, I've never seen their show. Like, it was great. It was that was also the theater scene in Chicago at that time. There were a lot of really cool experimental groups, like it's a group called Theater Ublick, and it's a group called Cook County Theater Department that Gary Wilms was in, and Richard Maxwell, who's now an Obie Award-winning playwright in New York City. And it was a really vital theater scene that was going on there.
At the same time, at some point, you had to figure out how to make comedy a profession. if you wanted to spend that much time on it.
That was it. And then so I auditioned for Second City just because how many auditions can you do that are improv? And I thought, yeah, I might as well. Not expecting to get in. And I got in and they paid. And that was it. So eventually, about a year after that, because you start off kind of slow at Second City, I told them, I said, I gotta leave. I got to pay my rent. And they made the greatest trade since Lou Brock for – what's that famous terrible baseball trade? Lou Brock for some guy you've never heard of. And I left the group.
I'm going to say Jeff Bagwell for Larry Anderson. That's the one that I like remember off
That's
the top.
That's very good. That's very good. That's a little more modern too. And so they traded me for Amy Poehler. And the rest is history. And so they were like, oh, McKay left for about a week. And then it was Amy Poehler. And they're like, wait a minute. And they kind of shot like a rocket ship. And it worked out great for all of us. I got to go to Second City and got hired by SNL. And then they all moved to New York. So I still got to do improv with them. And it's been very cool to see that theater just grow and grow.
I want to play a sketch that you wrote at the Second City. And this is the scene where you are Mr. Grissom, who is a corporate bigwig, and you get called into the HR office after having taken some, like, aptitude tests.
Question number one on your test, Mr. Grissom, read, complete this sequence of numbers. Mm-hmm. 2, 4, 6, blank.
Good.
For your answer, you drew a picture of a snowman. You wrote, happy, happy foot time. That would be an incorrect answer.
Are you sure about that, Jerry? Have you checked the answer key?
I don't need to check the answer key, Mr. Grissom. This is a simple
question. Well, I check
question.
A lot of answer keys in my time,
well,
Jerry. You might want to check
positive
this.
Numbers.
Jerry, I'm a vice president. These are $40 socks. Let's check the key, huh?
Mr. Grissom, the key is right here. The answer is 8. It's not foot time.
Well, not quite, no. Let's get ahead of ourselves, Jerry.
Mr. Grissom, according to these test results, you have no sense of object permanence. This is a basic thing we establish when we're 6 months to a year old that allows us to understand that when your parents leave, they're not gone forever. Or when an object goes behind an object, it still exists. Well, I can show you right now.
Jerry? Jerry! Well, where the hell were you? Myself, Jerry, I'm a busy man.
Mr. Grissom, you're 44 years old and we basically just played peekaboo.
Well, I didn't enjoy it.
Oh my God, Scott Adsit too. Oh, he's the best.
Scott Adsit, who folks might know from 30 Rock, among other places. The tone of that sketch, I think maybe even more than the many great things that you wrote with and for Will Ferrell on SNL when you were head writer of SNL, is like where your career ended up more recently, which is it is just openly contemptuous of the idea of business leaders being business leaders and all the phoniness around being a business leader.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's accurate. I think what was great about Chicago was just that Chicago kind of, you know, ethos is that comedy blends with politics, blends with community, blends with social act. You know, everything is in the same pot in Chicago. And, you know, obviously the tradition of unionism in Chicago, Studs Terkel and all that kind of stuff. And that's what Del Close taught, too. His famous line was like, you know, aim for art or relevance. And if you miss, you'll get comedy. Aim for comedy and you miss and you get nothing. So he definitely encouraged that, and Second City's kind of built on that. Yeah, and we caused some trouble in those days too. I mean, we used to do a lot of protests and activism back then, usually with a theater base to it. And I remember we took over Navy Pier on the weekend that it opened because it was sponsored by Pepsi, and that this German company had bought all the sweetener companies, the corn syrup companies around the Midwest, and locked out the employees saying, we want to pay you half as much as you get. So we took over the Navy Pier pretending we were from Pepsi and then staged an entire scene where protesters were coming at us and we were humiliating them. And they started tearing up our Pepsi signs. And police showed up and actually arrested the actors playing the protesters. And I was one of the Pepsi guys, and I was like, oh, crap, what are we going to do? And then the cop came up to me and goes, how do you want to handle this? And I went, you know, I think Pepsi's taken enough brand damage today. Why don't we just let him go? And they're like, okay, gentlemen, you're free to go. And we all scurried off to our car, and it was like on a couple news stations. So, yeah, that's Chicago. It's a unique, interesting town in that regard.
I think that also maybe has something to do with your personal predilection, which is to just go all the way to it. I mean, even if silliness that you did on Saturday Night Live in Anchorman is still I always just had my breath taken away at how far you were willing to take the silliness.
Yeah, I think it goes back to when I was a kid, the stuff I loved. I mean, there's no better feeling than when you laugh so hard you have tears in your eyes. And certain jokes from when I was a kid, like an airplane, when the newspapers spin and they say people on airplane doomed to die, how will they land the airplane? And then the third newspaper says, boy trapped in refrigerator eats own foot. And I've talked to other comedy writers, like, I think that joke changed my life. And, you know, when I was way younger, even the Three Stooges, which is just the level of violence, it's almost like punk rock in that show. And I remember laughing so hard. And Amazon Women on the Moon. I remember O'Donohue on SNL. Like, that was the stuff that I was definitely drawn towards. And the thrill of just seeing someone go too far, to this day, I still get excited by it.
We'll wrap up my conversation with Adam McKay after a short break. He's making more serious movies these days, movies about real stuff that actually happened. And he'll tell me about how he manages to keep his films fresh, funny, and weird, even when Will Ferrell isn't in them. It's Bullseye from MaximumFun.org and NPR. This message comes from NPR sponsor Green Chef. Green Chef is a USDA-certified organic meal kit offering plans for every lifestyle, including paleo, plant-powered, keto, and balanced living. With their wide variety of high-quality, clean ingredients, seasonally sourced for peak freshness, you can feel great about what you're eating and how it got to your table. Get $90 off your first month, including free shipping, at greenchef.com/90bullseye and use code 90bullseye.
On NPR's Pop Culture Happy Hour podcast, we talk about movies, music, and more, like why The Great Pottery Throwdown is a comforting binge watch, and a look back at some of Chadwick Boseman's essential performances. All of that in around 20 minutes every weekday. Listen now to the Pop Culture Happy Hour podcast from NPR.
The Beef and Dairy Network is a multi-award-winning comedy podcast here on Maximum Fun, and I would recommend you listen to it. But don't just take it from me. What do the listeners have to say?
I would rather stick a corkscrew inside my ear, twist it around and pull out my ear canal like a cork than listen to your stupid podcast ever again. Please stop contacting me.
Hell would freeze over before I recommended this podcast, the Beef and Dairy Network, to anyone.
Not in a million years. Actually, scratch that. Make it a billion years. No, how long's infinity?
That's the Beef and Dairy Network podcast, available at MaximumFun.org and at all good and some bad podcast platforms.
Disgusting.
Welcome back to Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. My guest is Adam McKay. He's a filmmaker, ordinarily. He directed the movies Anchorman, Step Brothers, The Big Short, and Vice, among others. These days, he's dipping his toes into the waters of podcasting. Death at the Wing tells the story of a handful of young NBA recruits whose lives were cut short in the 1980s. It's out now. Adam and I talked in 2019.
When you went to work at Saturday Night Live as a writer, you initially auditioned for a cast role, but ended up getting a writing job on the show. Were you familiar with Will Ferrell and his work and reputation? He had been L.A.-based, I think.
Mm-hmm. No, we had no idea who he was. He's also a much more secure, healthy person than myself and my friends. So we were all from Chicago, and we were nonstop doing bits, nonstop joking around, and he just doesn't do that. He's a pretty normal guy if you bump into him. And so we all just thought he was the straight guy. And then the very first read-through, he just uncorked like four of the funniest sketches you've ever heard, characters, full commitment. We were like, holy cow. But the reason we really connected was because we were doing bits all the time. And it turned out Farrell loved to do bits. And he just started showing up in our office and jumping into the bits we would do. And he was really good at them. And he loved it. And then, like, after 6 months, he's like, yeah, I just wanted to hang out with you guys because you're always doing bits. And that was the kind of foundation. And then we wrote a sketch together. I think the first one we wrote was Neil Diamond Storytellers. It's actually hard to find, I think, because of the music rights. But it went really well. And it was just such a joy to write with him. We just started writing together more and more.
What did you figure out was funny about Will Ferrell that is special?
I think his dead commitment, like just total all out, like no wink in his eyes commitment. He also, we both have a very similar sense of humor. We love when stuff gets out of control. We love the idea of seeing something on TV or in a movie that you're not supposed to see. That's not supposed to happen. And he has this great, like, all-American face. It almost seems like he could have been in, like, you know, some sort of action TV show in the 80s or something. Like, he's kind of handsome, but, like, it's a little off, and he just knows how to use it so well. And what's so impressive about him is he can kind of play every kind of comedy. He's actually a great straight man, which he doesn't get to do very often, but a really good straight man. So, we both about the same age, both came from divorced parents. His dad was a musician, is a musician. My dad's a musician. It was a kind of a freaky thing of just the same age, same influences. And neither one of us are big hand wringers. Like, we do the best work we can do. We rewrite our stuff. We want it to be good. But, you know, there would be some people at SNL that would work on a sketch all day long for 14 hours and then at the last second pull it from the read-through because they didn't think it was good enough. Farrell and I would never do that. We'd just be like, well, it's the read-through. If it doesn't work, it doesn't work. And, yeah, it's just a really good match. I think in all the years, we've never had one single creative argument ever.
The movies that you made with Farrell, including the Anchorman movies and Talladega Nights and so forth, are all so intensely packed with so many crazy jokes that they border on incoherency.
I think that's fair. Depending on who you are.
Yeah. And I mean, to varying extents, the other guy is structurally a pretty straight genre movie.
Sure.
With some jokes like that in it.
Yeah.
And I love all these movies. I want to be really clear about this.
That's fine.
But I wonder what it was like to transition from making a movie that is as crazy as Anchorman or Anchorman 2, where, you know, on Anchorman you had so many bits that weren't in the movie that you made a second movie of feature length out of the stuff that was left out of the first movie. Into making a movie that is about real things that really happened, where you're responsible to some extent for representing, like, documentary truth. And you have to plot it out so that this really complicated thing can be explained in the course of the narrative as well.
Well, it's funny hearing you phrase it like that. It actually makes more sense than I would think it would make, because they're both kind of the same thing. With the comedies, you're breaking routine, you're shocking, you're going into the world of absurdity, and you're kind of jarring an audience. You're screwing with their expectations. And that's exactly what needed to happen in The Big Short and Vice, because if you just list the details of the financial crisis, everyone glazes over. But if you can think of a way to give it a pop and a life and connect and break routine, when the whole story of the financial crisis is really a break in routine, or as Adam Davidson called it, you know, they use weaponized boredom to kind of get away with this kind of stuff. So we have to kind of break that weaponized boredom. And the same thing with Dick Cheney. He uses this kind of bureaucratic, quiet, cranky professionalism to just make it all seem like this is normal. So, yeah, in both cases, rather than it being a big, absurdist, comedic moment that we're breaking the routine with, that we're screwing with the form of a movie, It's the financial crisis. It's the esoteric underlying algorithms behind these products that were being sold. In the case of Dick Cheney, it's the real world impact of these paper pushing decisions that seem so innocuous initially. So, yeah, hearing you phrase it like that, I think that's exactly kind of what happened. It's still about kind of keeping an audience off kilter, off balance, not letting them settle into traditional sequential beats in a movie.
Yeah, I mean, you run credits halfway through the new movie. And, you know, in a way, it's like it shares some DNA with the kind of borderline situationist stuff you were doing in person in Chicago, which is the theory of that is that your goal is to give someone an authentic and immediate experience by taking them out of the mundanity of their lives, that there's this kind of drumbeat that we all have that we, you know, we go through the motions of our lives without even noticing, much less appreciating what's going on. And in breaking that somehow, you kind of bring people into what's going on right in front of them.
Yeah, I think that's fair. You're right. I think it's a consistent thread that runs through what we're doing. I think in Vice, I think the kind of urgency of it went to another level. I was joking with my editor that, like, we're definitely showing our pit stains in this movie. We're definitely not being cool about it. We are fully waving our arms in the air and saying something is very, very wrong. So it's less cool in Vice, and Vice, you know, in this current climate that we live in, you know, stumbled into the red versus blue nonsense that kind of filters every basic fact that we encounter in this world. So that's kind of a hornet's nest unto itself. But I think the use of that kind of routine breaking, formula breaking style in Vice is more to say, hey, things are really, really wrong on a bigger, grander scale. And depending on who the person is, some people love that, some people hate that. You know, there's a lot of people that like the cool remove of watching the world click by. And in that movie, we're definitely saying, no, no, no. I want to break as many moments as I can. I want people to be inside of this. There was someone who said, like, you know, like it or not, as the audience in Vice, you're involved in this movie. And I thought, that's pretty great. I can stand by that for better or for worse, depending on your opinion. There's no doubt the audience is very involved in that movie.
Adam McKay, I'm so grateful to you for taking the time to be on Bullseye. It was really nice to get to meet you, and I've admired your work for so long.
Thank you for having me on. This was fun.
Adam McKay, his new podcast, Death at the Wing, is out now wherever you listen to podcasts. That's the end of another episode of Bullseye. Bullseye is created from the homes of me and the staff of Maximum Fun in and around Greater Los Angeles, California, where I learned that the construction site dirt that covers my car every day is something called fugitive dust. I don't know. Maybe that's useful to you. Didn't help me, unfortunately. The show is produced by Speaking Into Microphones. Our producer is Kevin Ferguson. Jesus Ambrosio and Jordan Cowling are our associate producers. We get help from Casey O'Brien. Production fellows at Maximum Fun are Richard Roby and Valerie Moffett. Our interstitial music is by Dan Wally, also known as DJW. Our theme song is by The Go Team. Thanks very much to them and their label Memphis Industries for sharing it. You can also keep up with the show on Twitter, Facebook, and YouTube. We post all our interviews there. And I think that's about it. Just remember, all great radio hosts have a signature sign-off.
Bullseye with Jesse Thorne is a production of MaximumFun.org and is distributed by NPR.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Shopify, the global commerce platform that helps you sell and show up exactly the way you want to. Customize your online store to your style. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/NPR. This message comes from NPR sponsor Homes.com. You don't just live in your home, you live in your neighborhood as well. So when you're shopping for a home, you want to know as much about the area around it as possible. Luckily, Homes.com has got you covered. Each listing features a comprehensive neighborhood guide from local experts. Everything you'd ever want to know about a neighborhood, including the number of homes for sale, local amenities, and even things like median lot size and a noise score. Homes.com. We've done your homework.
This message comes from The Run-Through with Vogue. Listen as designers, Vogue editors, and industry icons like Erykah Badu and Florence Pugh have in-depth conversations about fashion and culture. New episodes are released each Thursday wherever you get your podcasts.